welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are grateful that you are spending time with us. And you know, when it comes to bragging rights, North Dakota's got a lot more to offer than just wide open skies and prairie winds. And no one tells the story better than Sarah Audie Coleman. She's been at the helm of our state's tourism efforts for more than two decades. And if you've ever seen a national ad that made you think, hey, maybe I should visit North Dakota, well, she probably had something to do with it. And in the second half of today's show, Sarah will sit down and visit with Prairie Public's CEO, John Harris. And as we begin Main Street today, we want to explore the launch of the North Dakota Center for Aerospace Medicine at the University of North Dakota. It's a groundbreaking collaboration between aviation and medical professionals to support the unique health needs of pilots and aviation workers. Joining me to discuss are Elizabeth Mierke and Jess Doty. She is the Director of Student Health Services at the University of North Dakota, and Elizabeth is Associate Dean of the John D. Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences at the University of North Dakota. To both of you, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you both. Let's start with the big picture. What is the North Dakota Center for Aerospace Medicine, and why did it need to be created?
So I can take this one. So the North Dakota Center for Aerospace Medicine really is bringing together all the right experts that already reside at the University of North Dakota. As everyone's aware, we have a medical school at UND. We also have a very large College of Aerospace Sciences with about 2,000 aviation students and a very busy flight operations. We have a UND student health that has been providing aviation medicals for pilots and air traffic controllers for well over three or four decades. We also have departments of psychology and human factors and physiology. So again, we had all the right players here at UND, and we've just taken initiative the last few years of really bringing everyone together to be able to add value both on the research side, the education side, the outreach, and most important also the medical service side to pilots and air traffic controllers.
So what does aerospace medicine mean?
I can kind of jump in and answer that one. Aerospace medicine is something unique. So the aerospace industry, especially, I'll talk mainly about pilots, is an industry that requires a medical certification, a process that's deemed by the FAA to allow pilots to fly safely, right? So they have to undergo a medical physical routinely. I kind of call it the driver's license for pilots, right? But they need a medical certificate and have specific medical doctors trained by the FAA to provide these exams and allow them to do to fly. We have a couple of AMEs at UND Student Health Services that can do these physicals. And where the rubber hit the road is when we learned that pilots were needing to they weren't getting help for mental health or substance use, or there was a lot less resources available. So what this initiative is really doing is trying to get access to AMEs in the state of North Dakota. We have them here in Grand Forks, and we've had them for our pilots on campus, but expanding that to the state of North Dakota and enhancing it with specialists that are able to do the mental health and the substance use work right here in the state of North Dakota as well.
You talk about a unique need, I think, for pilots when you touch on the mental health aspects of the program. And I think many of us have read that there are mental health challenges that pilots are afraid to address because, hey, I could be out of a job tomorrow if I asked for help. Where does this program fit into that continuum of care?
So that is really the impetus that got us all together to start talking about this. In fact, it was really during the COVID pandemic, you know, we started realizing that there were special needs with our students, and it was a challenging time for everyone around the country and around the world, but especially for pilots and aviation students where they felt they couldn't seek the help they needed. So at that time in 2021, we actually created a task force internal to UND, bringing in these experts from around campus, really talking about the need for our students as we navigated the pandemic. Then tragedy struck our program in October of 2021, where one of our students committed suicide at one of our aircraft. And that really made us really think this is bigger than just a UND issue. We're still in this uncharted time. We need to go more national. And we started building our relationships with other schools, with other airlines, with the FAA to see what services are available. And actually started hosting our first aviation mental health symposium in December of 21 that we've continued to host annually, not just for UND, but for really collegiate programs around the country, bringing everyone together. And And then we sort of started investing in these resources because we realized in the state of North Dakota, if we had a student that was struggling with anxiety or depression, they would have to fly to Denver or Rochester, Minnesota, or someplace quite a ways away to see the specialist they needed with that aviation medical certification standard. So we started building up the resources here on campus to serve our students and their needs. And now this new bill that was passed by the North Dakota State Legislature allows us to take what we've built here at UND and serve the state of North Dakota. North Dakota has the highest pilot per capita rate in the country. And so again, we're happy to be able to take this now and expand that access to pilots across the state of North Dakota.
Give me a sense of the collaboration you spoke about earlier, about bringing in all different genres, so to speak, of medicine to support those who are becoming pilots, are in the future, those who are already pilots.
One of the things I'll mention with the collaboration first on the national side, then I'll let Jess speak more specifically more about kind of the healthcare profession in general. One of the neat things that coincided with the state bill that was passed is also a cooperative agreement that we've recently signed with the Federal Aviation Administration themselves. That's really going to help sort of the research side of this piece come into play. In fact, the FAA now has one of their medical researchers embedded here at UND as well, kind of serving as that liaison for the work that we're doing at the University of North Dakota to tie into some of the research initiatives and the needs that are needed at that federal level, the national level. So we're really hoping that this center will be able to allow us to do some really groundbreaking research when it comes to rural health, access to care, that will really help not just our state, but also the U.S. in general as they tackle this initiative.
Is it hard for pilots to access care like this today, generally speaking?
I wouldn't say, I don't know if I use the word hard, Craig, but I do think that there isn't a lot of access here in our region, in our state, right? There are practices in some of the big cities around the country, but it's a limited amount. It's definitely a specialty group that's doing this aviation work. It's not, you can't just go into any of your doctor's office anywhere and find a medical professional who's able to do this. It's definitely a specialty. And we were finding that in the state of North Dakota, there was very, very limited amounts of medical doctors who could do these exams. I don't know if there were any psychologists or psychiatrists located in our state. And now we've partnered or collaborated with our counseling center to be able to do psychological assessments that the FAA would need for pilots.
Yeah, it makes me wonder. So someone who goes through this program, what do they end with? And then where will they go?
So the actual HIMSS program is I think what you're referring to. The HIMSS program is a program that is it's a lengthy program, right? It's a program that the pilot definitely has to be engaged in for a long period of time with their HIMSS AME or a specific doctor that they are assigned to.
Let me interject just real quick. That HIMSS stands for Human Intervention Motivational Study.
Correct.
Go ahead.
And that's the identified program that the FAA looks at for pilots who are dealing with substance use and mental health issues when they want to keep being a pilot, keep flying an aircraft. They need to go through this program to keep their medical certificate and keep doing their occupation. So it's a lengthy program. It requires a lot of different assessments and different potentially lab testing and those sorts of things. The goal, if I am making the assumption, the goal is that the pilot can be stay flying, right? Like to get to that point where you're still able to be a pilot and still able to live out your passion in your career. But it is a lengthy process that requires a lot of dedication from the pilot.
Anything to add, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I'll just add, so when it comes to the mental health challenges that individuals face, so depression and anxiety are pretty common amongst the U.S. population. And this is one of those areas that, again, historically, if a pilot had, was diagnosed with anxiety or depression, that invalidated their aviation medical. So they could no longer flight train, they could no longer fly for a living. The FAA has come around in recent years, and they're continuously changing their rules and the requirements. But for example, if a pilot has depression and they know they should be on an antidepressant, they are able to do that by working through a HIMSS aviation medical examiner, but it's going to require them to go through psychological assessments. They're going to have to be on an SSRI for a minimum of 6 months on the same dose, and then they can start the paperwork with the FAA to navigate to get that medical back. And so it's a very complex, lengthy process for pilots, and it's hard to navigate on your own without that advocate in your back pocket that understands the process. And so that's what we're building up here at UND, is that expertise, that knowledge, that connection with understanding the FAA process to make it easier for pilots that, again, they know they need help and they're going to do function much better in society, in life, in their job. With that simple SSRI, now we're helping them take down those barriers so that they will seek the help they need to be healthy versus just not seeking help and then having it get worse.
Certainly that would be the worst case for sure. Mm-hmm. Enjoying our conversation with Elizabeth Bierke. She's the Associate Dean of the John D. Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences at the University of North Dakota. And Jess Doty, she's the Director of Student Health Services at the University of North Dakota. And we're talking about the North Dakota Center for Aerospace Medicine. It's a new program that has just been approved and then funded partially for by the North Dakota legislature. And let's talk about that funding. The North Dakota legislature set aside $250,000 for the program. University also plays a role in this. How is that funding going to be used to now set up and then launch the program?
So again, the University of North Dakota has already invested in this concept, and that's what's allowed us to build up this area of expertise, both with our HIMSS AMEs and our psychologists and neuropsychologists. What the state funding is going to allow us to do is to be able to expand these services to other pilots across the state. So some of the things we're looking at doing is bringing in additional support, especially on the psychology, the psychologist side, to be able to provide some of that mental health services to pilots across the state to help them navigate this. The other big thing to use this, that we'll utilize this funding for, is education and outreach. So not just education and outreach to the pilot community, but also education and outreach to the mental health or the health professionals across the state of North Dakota, so that family practice doctors understand if they're working with a pilot or a soon-to-be pilot, that they understand this FAA medical certification process, and also knowing that the university has resources to assist in that area, as well as also mental health professionals across the state, just making them aware that regulatory medicine for the pilot population is different than the general population.
So is the Center for Aerospace Medicine offering a certificate program, a degree program? What is it?
So that's a great question. We're not offering a educational program per se. We are looking at the education and outreach piece of pilots. We're also looking with our medical school. We're in collaborations to do a fourth year medical student rotation to expose them, those medical students, to aerospace medicine, so that when they graduate from the University of North Dakota and go on with their careers, they are already aware of this subspecialty. And maybe some of them will be interested in becoming aviation medical examiners themselves down the road.
Will the center then also support professionals? We've talked about pilots, right? But what about fields like unmanned aircraft systems controllers or air traffic controllers? We've all read and heard about the stress that they incur.
Yes, really, the center can help any of those aviation professions or aerospace professions. And we're, big vision is we're thinking space is even something that is coming, that is a more normal thing, right? Space tourism and those sorts of concepts. And so that we're trying to keep our vision wide enough for that. But yes, it'll help any of those industry professionals that are working with the FAA and needing those medical certificates to keep doing their profession and still get the medical care and medical help that they would need to perform their duties the best they can.
So what is the role of the FAA then in the genesis of this program, and then in the future of the program? How is that interaction? What does it look like?
So we've got great interaction with the FAA. For example, last summer, a group of us from UND, from our medical school, from our student health, from our aerospace college, actually went to visit the Civil Aviation Medical Institute that the FAA has in Oklahoma City. And we had some great collaboration discussions during that visit. And then in November, we hosted their team on our campus so they could see that, yes, UND does have a full medical school. We have this large aerospace college. We tour student health and talk to their physicians. And so that's what's created this cooperative agreement and this willingness for us to really work together to do research and do education outreach that's going to benefit for sure our university, our state of North Dakota, but also hopefully implement change around the country as well. So they're definitely engaged. And when they came to North Dakota, I don't think everyone, necessarily knows what to expect when they come to North Dakota, but they were, I think, blown away by our facilities, our faculty, our staff, our expertise in this arena.
I'm still surprised that North Dakota has per capita more pilots than any other state in the country. That just, I guess, is a surprise to me, something I really haven't thought about. Is this program, is the desire of the program to become a model for other universities, or does it exist elsewhere and we're now bringing it here? What's the shape of the situation, I guess, from a national perspective?
You know, when I talk about it, I think we really have the opportunity to be a model, especially for states with rural populations like North Dakota. And so that's what excites me, is to be able to put together some best practices, work closely with the FAA to streamline some of the work that is being done, but really serve as that kind of model that could be duplicated. Because again, we have to have numerous resources for pilots that are geographically dispersed throughout the United States. So again, if we can have more of these models in place, that would benefit and reduce those barriers.
What's the timeline then for, as we're speaking today, to next year, to maybe 5 years from now, 10 years from now with the program?
So some of the things we've already got, we're ready, right? Some of the clinical components we're already working on. We're taking pilots for AME physicals, and HIMSS AME services are available at Student Health Services. Some of those clinical components are active. We're building up the research side with the collaboration that we have through the FAA at this point, and working on getting that education and outreach throughout. So I think in the next couple of years, I think we'll see some good action in those steps now that we've got support of the legislation and a little bit of momentum to get us moving in that direction.
For listeners who aren't really familiar with the aviation world, there are some myths out there, I think, about aerospace medicine and pilot health and pilot mental health. What are a couple of those myths maybe that you would like to clear up right now? And I'm thinking about, geez, is it okay for my pilot of my plane to be on SSRIs, antidepressants? And my thought is, heck yeah, it is, because I know what the alternative means. Are there other myths that are out there about pilot health that we should be, that you can maybe clear up for us?
I would say, I mean, the most important thing to understand is, for pilots and air traffic controllers, their personal health is what matters most, you know, and again, that's a tough decision. We've done a lot of research on pilot healthcare seeking behavior. And the simple fact is, pilots are scared to seek out healthcare because they're scared that it may ground them and lessen their livelihood for that period of time. And that's concerning. So I think we're starting here with our student population at UND, really stressing the importance of your physical and mental well-being to just be a healthy individual. Because again, we don't want pilots not seeking healthcare when they need it, obviously. But I would agree, yes, again, the FAA is working on those processes. They've done a lot in a short period of time. I was part of a large aviation rulemaking committee last year that really looked at pilot medical clearances and certifications. So with the, again, you can have depression or anxiety. There is a process to go through. But once you go through that, there's many pilots flying today that are successfully, you know, being treated for their depression or anxiety. And that's exactly what we want. We want pilots to be on that SSRI if they need it versus not seeking healthcare for their symptoms. I guess another one that we see oftentimes here just within our program, myths and facts sometimes too, but vision, you know, there's still this thought that pilots have to have perfect 20/20 vision, you know, and that's correct. They need to have good vision, but it can be corrected vision. It could be contact lenses or glasses. That is fine. Color blindness, that is another area that young people don't necessarily know that they are colorblind. And so there are limitations on aviation medicals based on color blindness. And then the other one that, again, isn't quite changing as fast as a depression anxiety would be ADHD. So anyone with a diagnosis of ADHD, and we tend to see that a lot with a younger student population, there is a process as well for clearance into that. And that one does not allow pilots to be on medication for ADHD and pilot an aircraft. I don't know, Jess, if you have anything to add.
No, I just think it's important to add that pilots are in a really unique situation having this these requirements or these medical certificates that they need, right? Many of the other professionals, like we used in our testimony, a neurosurgeon necessarily doesn't even have the same requirements that a pilot does, as far as they can go get a diagnosis and be on the medications that they would need for blood pressure or diabetes or depression or anxiety. And you can be a professor, you can be a teacher, you can be a doctor, you can be a lot of different things, but pilots have a very unique situation. And so I think echoing what Beth said a little bit with just overall the general well-being of that human, that pilot, is important, and trying to get that to be the first step. And then we can work through the rest of those things and trying to get the research or the support and the access to clinical guidance, I guess, getting the AMEs or getting them so that they can know how to navigate through that process is a big piece. And that's what our center is trying to help accomplish.
How are students accepting or learning that it is okay for me to seek assistance? How do you communicate to them that, you know what, this is the proper thing to do. This is the suggested, this is the best thing you can do when you're having trouble.
I think one of the neatest things that we implemented during the COVID pandemic was really based on best practices in the United States and the airlines. So the airlines have something called peer support programs. And so these are pilot peers that volunteer. They're trained in by a mental health professional. They're overseen with mental health professional, but they provide confidential anonymous support to other pilots that are going through rough times and need that individual. And they're trained on how to escalate them up to the mental health professional if need be. And so we learned about these during our initial days with our task force, and we actually implemented a peer support program here at UND called Uplift. These are student volunteers. We have an embedded psychologist who works for the UND Counseling Center that oversees these peers, and we educate the students from day one. Now, this is an anonymous, confidential program that is available to them. And I think that has been a really great addition to our program that, again, is leveraged on best practice that the airlines have been doing for, you know, quite a long time. And it helps bring that stigma down. And it's just, you make it very visible. It's known. Our embedded psychologist goes into many of our classes, talks about mental health, well-being, and, of course, is always available for our students as well.
Where can people find out more about the North Dakota Center for Aerospace Medicine as it evolves?
I think one of the main resources will be, we'll be putting together some resources on a webpage to get information out there. Right now there's some information on the UND webpage, but that'll broaden out as we grow and become the North Dakota Center. And then also within the pilot community, there's a lot of interaction. There's been a lot of conference attendance and tabling and navigating that way. And so I think within that community, there is already those pieces happening, that networking has been happening, and that will only continue and grow.
That's Jess Doty. She's been my guest along with Elizabeth Bierke. Jess is the Director of Student Health Services at the University of North Dakota, and Elizabeth is the Associate Dean of the John D. Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences at the University of North Dakota. As someone who's relatively new to the state, it just is amazing to me, the aerospace activity and the aviation activity at the University of North Dakota. So best wishes to both of you and to the rest of the school.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
This bird song sounds like a nasally imitation of a robin, and the bird singing it is a rusty brown riff on a Baltimore Oriole. Called the orchard oriole, males have chestnut-colored breasts and black backs and wings, while females and immature birds are mostly yellow. Orchard orioles are very social birds, often with a few nesting pairs sharing the same large tree among stream banks, wetlands, and other shrubby areas. As early as late July, male orchard orioles head south for the winter. Their young are still just juveniles learning to find food, so they stick with the adult females, searching together for mulberries and other late summer fruits. Although common, these birds have been in a slow decline for over 50 years. When habitats along streams are damaged by grazing cattle, orchard orioles often can't use the area for nesting anymore. Protecting streamside vegetation helps these colorful birds, along with a whole suite of other species that depend on clean water and lots of leafy trees and shrubs. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Support for BirdNote is provided by Sarah Murner and Craig McKibben from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
Still to come on Main Street, when it comes to bragging rights, North Dakota offers a lot more than just big skies and prairie winds, and Sarah Audie Coleman knows how to make the case. She is the longtime director of the state's tourism efforts and is the driving force behind the campaigns that have people across the country saying, you know, North Dakota looks like somewhere I need to visit. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by A Taste of Ireland, a live music and dance production featuring international Irish dance champions, coming to Grand Forks June 8th. Information at atasteofirelandshow.com.
Welcome back to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Prairie Public's CEO John Harris sits down with North Dakota Tourism Director Sarah Audie Coleman in this excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show. Director Coleman talks about all of the great things our state has to offer, especially important now that tourism season is underway.
Sarah, welcome, and tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, great to be here. So I direct the tourism and marketing efforts for the state of North Dakota. So primarily trying to attract visitors to the state. We also do the talent attraction marketing and some other marketing as well, but have been doing that for a number of years, more than a couple decades. And so prior to that, I marketed Bismarck Mandan to groups and conventions and visitors. So I've been in the industry a long time, and it's just fun to really be able to highlight all the great things to do and see across our state.
Yeah. Well, you've been a regular here in the spring because we always want to talk about what's going on. Maybe not a lot changed, but let's start off with, tell us a little bit about, what year 24 was like for tourism.
Yeah, you know, we had a good year last year. Some areas were up, some were flat, some were, slightly down. National park visitation was pretty stable. We saw strong increases in flights, people flying in. So that's pretty interesting. That was up about 10%, and that continues to grow. And we do some marketing. You know, while most of our visitation is drive, we do marketing in the direct flight cities, Chicago and Phoenix and Minneapolis and Denver. So those were good numbers. We saw in 24, we actually saw an increase of Canadians, about 10% increase of Canadians coming over the border. Still not reaching pre-pandemic levels, but still moving in the right direction. Hotel was fairly flat, but we were up in terms of revenue and both of the sales tax categories that are generated from the tourism industry, accommodations and food services and arts, entertainment and recreation were both up significantly.
Yeah. So what do the prospects look like for this summer?
You know, we're optimistic. There's a lot of factors in play right now, but Americans in general are planning vacations. Just about every poll I've looked at, every survey of Americans and American travelers specific, most of them are prioritizing travel, even in a tighter economy. They're prioritizing those experiences, and travel is one of the things that they really want to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of things we'll talk about, but Mindoro is a big destination point with the musical there, and understand they've got a new leader hired to lead the musical. Can you comment about the impact that might have, and also just the impact Mindoro and the Theodore Roosevelt National Park have?
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt National Park's our number one attraction in terms of what motivates non-residents into the state. And so we're always, always excited to work with them and to really feature the benefits of the national park and the fact that it isn't crowded. And, we've got a lot of the same services and beautiful views and trails and access, and you don't have to fight for a parking spot, so to speak, or wait in line for an hour to get through the gates. And so we'll continue to market that. Medora, is the gateway city to the South Unit. It's actually the 60th anniversary for the musical this year. They did change the production company last year, and then this year they'll have new hosts again. And I know they've announced some of their Burning Hill Singers and the band and whatnot. So it's always fun to see that show kick off. But they've also really diversified their other entertainment options, even throughout the winter. Every weekend they had entertainment and concerts that were sold out. And so that's pretty exciting to see, see more offerings beyond. They've also expanded their point-to-point trail, which is right in Medora. If you just kind of go up the hill on the kind of the east side of Medora, they've expanded that kind of into where some of the trail riding trails were. So you can now hike all of that, which is great if you don't, especially hikers. If you're going to go out in the national park one day, then you can, hike right in there the next day. But then we also want to mention Watford City, because they're kind of the gateway city to the North Unit at Theodore Roosevelt National Park. And You know, they also just continue to grow their amenities. They've got great restaurants and coffee shops and ice cream stores, and their visitor center is just, you know, great as well. And so, and they actually just had a golf course, a brand new golf course that they had done out there. And so that's also another place to consider if you haven't been to the North Unit lately.
Okay. Well, staying with Theodore Roosevelt, how excited are you about the library that as a tourist destination when that opens, and what's that looking like?
We are really excited about the library, to say the least. This is really going to put North Dakota on the map. Theodore Roosevelt is just so well loved by so many people, and this isn't just a library. This is going to be a world-renowned museum and library with programming and how it's melded into the landscape really ties into, you know, his conservation ethics and the ability to even explore it without, you know, even if you don't pay for an admission, you'll be able to enjoy so much just from the outside and the boardwalk and how they're going to interpret that. And so, yeah, we're really excited for it. That'll kind of be our big America's, for America's 250th. That's kind of when that will kick off next year. But we're working already, you know, getting media, telling the story, getting people excited about it.
So what are y'all talking about of the concerns of, you know, potential job cuts to national parks across the U.S. for that matter, but how it might affect North Dakota?
Yeah, we're obviously concerned about that. Initially, earlier this spring, there was some concerns that with retirees, you know, they offered early retirements to a lot of folks and seasonals. Now, the seasonals, they did hire, all of those were in place. And so, as far as I know, we've got good staffing at both the North and South units here and, of course, the Elkhorn unit. None of the programming will be changed. At one point there was thoughts that maybe some of the events might have to be canceled, but none of that is happening at this point. So we're excited and hopeful that the national park operations, you know, will continue as planned. There are some other cuts that Senator Burgum just announced last week regarding specifically non-national park sites that are managed by the National Park Service. And so it's just really kind of too early to tell what those all might entail, but like National Historic Sites and some of those other sites looking at some budget cuts in those areas. So we'll have to dig into that and determine if that impacts, you know, Fort Union or Knife River or any of our other attractions.
Well, I don't know. You mentioned former Governor Burgum, now Secretary Burgum. Has that had any impact for you at all, just with the notoriety of a North Dakotan?
Well, you know, it's
being in that position.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I try to assure my colleagues around the country, because obviously there's uncertainty, and I'm chair of our National Council of State Tourism Directors, and just past chair of our Western States Tourism Policy Council group. And what I remind them is, you know, we know there's volatile times right now. We know, you know, there's uncertainty, and everybody's got concerns, but Governor Burgum loves the national parks, and he loves the land and believes in the mission of the National Park Service. And so I think while they get through some of these bumps at the Department of the Interior, I know he'll have, you know, the American people in mind when he makes those decisions.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to, I guess, another concern you might have. With the tariffs and the Canadian tariffs I'm talking about here, the Canadian traffic to North Dakota might change a little bit. And there've been talks about it, and anecdotally I've heard some different things. So what are y'all talking about at the state level with concerns over all of this?
Yeah, we are very concerned about our Canadian visitation for the summer. January was actually up slightly. But February we saw double-digit decreases, and March was also down more than 20% in terms of border crossing. So I think we were 17 and 24% down, which is significant. That's the number of vehicles, but also the number of people in each vehicle is down. So what we're seeing is that people are, you know, maybe the family who committed to this hockey tournament every year is going to still go to the hockey tournament, but everybody might not go. And yet some of the last minute trips we think aren't probably happening just because of the sentiment right now. I certainly have heard from a lot of Canadians with their concerns and try to try to assure them that, you know, we understand, you know, politics, we try to keep that out of our work, and we just want to welcome people, and we want them to know they're welcome. And so we've changed our marketing slightly. We delayed it a little bit, and now we're really doing a little bit less intrusive marketing, just letting them know that, you know, we understand, but when they're ready to come back, we're sure excited to have them back, because we have a lot more in common with them than we do have differences.
Yeah. So maybe tell us about some of the tourism conferences you've been to, and what's the discussion like there? And tell us about
it. Yeah, so we had our travel industry conference recently, and that was very well attended. I think there was a lot of energy. A lot of people were really just looking for insights on, you know, how do we stand out? How do we compete better in a marketplace where we know there's going to be more people, you know, trying to attract Americans specifically in our region? And so great collaboration, really good speakers. I think overall everybody's pretty optimistic about the year coming ahead. And then I was also recently at our regional, we call it the International Roundup, IRU, and it's with the consortium of states that we call the Great American West. So we market along with South Dakota, Wyoming, and Idaho globally. So we have seven different reps that work in like 13 or 14 different countries. And so what we were hearing from them was that Europeans and Scandinavians and the Nordic countries, you know, even Australia and New Zealand, they're still coming. They really haven't canceled dramatically. Some of the U.S. data is showing that people are flying in at the same rates from those countries. But the people that are coming for leisure visits, book those ahead of time. There's something they're planned on. You know, they've maybe been to other parts of America, and they really want to see the central part in the Great American West. And so we had actually a record number of tour operators at that event, especially from, you know, countries like Australia and New Zealand. So we're optimistic as well. We may see, you know, we'll be interested to see the following year what that looks like, because a lot of the bookings were already made and people didn't cancel.
Yeah. Well, you talked about Medora and Theodore Roosevelt National Park, but what are some of the other big attractions in the state?
Yeah, you know, we've got such an interesting variety, and that's, I think, what sets North Dakota apart. Sometimes people think, well, what do we have besides Medora? Well, Medora, you know, and the National Park obviously are there year-round, but those are really seasonal. And so what we really have all the time is a lot of our venues and a lot of events and activities and festivals that happen around those venues. So those are big attractions throughout the year. You know, this time of year, I feel like we kind of kick off with the car shows, where we've got all these great, you know, everybody wants to get their vehicles and their fun cars and motorcycles and show, and those are through main streets and venues throughout the state, and concerts, you know, everything from the Red River Valley Fair to the State Fair, to you know, North Dakota Country Fest. All of those kind of things really do attract people. Rodeos, you know, we have rodeos statewide, powwows statewide. A couple of the big rodeos, you know, we've got Rough Rider Days in Dickinson, and then Mandan Rodeo Days. But there's also the Rough Rider Cup Rodeo, which was the first time we hosted that one was last September. And that's Chad Berger, Bucking Bulls, sponsors that and coordinates that. And those were the top rodeo contenders in the world. And I was just astonished to see how many people came in from all over the country that, you know, literally had their phone up the entire time and are you know, videoing all of these performers, because it's one of those last chance rodeos to get to the finals. But then you also look at, you know, everything from, you know, state parks to historic sites to museums. You know, the state Heritage Center and museum and Capitol are, of course, big attractions. This, you know, this time of year, you know, people want to get out on the water. So there's, you know, there's a lot of those outdoor recreation related attractions as well. So we're really a collection of a lot of smaller ones, rather than some states where you have that one big attraction that everybody comes for.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about, what's the brand this year? Why are you branding the state this year?
So the brand hasn't changed. That's still Be Legendary. But we have, our campaign has been, we call it Hello. And it's a really fun campaign. It wasn't scripted. It just shows families out enjoying North Dakota. The energy and the vibrancy is just really fun. I think we filmed in 15 or 16 different communities last summer, and so the videos are running, the TV is running, the digital marketing is running, the print will really kick up in, or has kicked up in April and May. We've got all sorts of sponsorships, and so we're super excited for the new campaign. We think it kind of introduces our friendliness, right? We're known, so we're always hearing about how, you know, oh, North Dakota nice, everybody's so friendly. They just appreciated the fact that we were there. So we leaned into that. And then we also, it kind of has a dual meaning because so many people don't know anything about North Dakota. So it's kind of like, hello, you should know something about us. It's time you came to visit.
Mm-hmm. How many staff do you have in your division in around the state?
Yeah, so we have 14, but they also, as I mentioned, do all of the marketing for Talent Attraction, as well as the all the programs within the Department of Commerce.
Yeah. So. And how did you fare? Your division fair in the legislative session recently closed.
Yeah, you know, we took a little bit of a cut on the destination development grants. So that dropped about $10 million down to $15 million. Our marketing stayed pretty flat for on the tourism side, but some of the talent attraction marketing was eliminated. Okay. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Well, what about campsites? I know some people have talked about they're worried that campsites won't be open, won't have staff. Any comments on those?
Yeah, some of the federal campsites we are concerned about. We've been trying to reach out to the Corps of Engineers to confirm whether or not the closings are going to be season-wide or if they're just temporary closings until they figure out where they're at. But some of those other federal campsites we are concerned about and trying to monitor those. We'll try to keep our website up to date and current so people know where. But, you know, I think you think about the lakes and the rivers and those places that you traditionally go, but we've got a lot of other really cool places that you could camp. You know, you think about Buffalo Trails Winery. You can camp there. Fluffy Fields, they have a harvest host program. You know, they have room for a couple RVs there. Some of the golf courses, you know, you mentioned you've been out golfing. The Lynx course up by Williston Ray area, they actually have cabins that you can rent right on the course, or they have camping sites there as well. And then some of the other, you know, campsites that are, you know, that are really not well known, maybe the Juniper campsite or campground up in the North Unit, or some of them like around Killdeer in the Little Missouri, near the Little Missouri State Park, are another great option.
Yeah, you know, how critical during the summer are student employees or volunteer employees helping at the parks and attractions?
Yeah, they're critical, and that's one of the things that, you know, we wish we had more time to work on, is to educate especially people, younger people coming in, even in the middle school area, so that they understand what great experience it is, because it's those soft skills. You know, it's those soft skills that they learn and employers love. So we're hopeful that a lot of people will want to get some experience in the hospitality industry.
Sarah, we've got a couple of minutes, but what's the best part of your job?
Oh, you know, I think the best part is just being able to brag about the state. You know, you get to talk about all that's good about the state. You get to dispel a lot of myths. You know, people think it's cold all the time and it's flat and there's nothing to see. And it's just fun to dispel those myths and to show them, you know, what there is to see and do, whether it's through the marketing or by hosting them here in state.
Well, that's interesting. If people want more information, if they want to find out more, where's the best place for them to go? What can they do?
They should go to ndtourism.com. Great trip itineraries, ideas there. Events are all listed there. Accommodations, campsites, you can find it all there. ndtourism.com.
Well, if they had one or two things to do in North Dakota outside of Medora and the Theodore Roosevelt Park, I guess I've taken, where would you point people?
You know, our conference was in Minot this year, and downtown Minot is doing some really fun things. Great energy and continually improving. So I think even just going to those communities that you maybe haven't been to, checking out their Main Street, checking out some of their new amenities and some of the new activities that they have throughout the state, that's what I would encourage.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, it's always fun to have you because you bring new, exciting things for us to hear about. Well, we thank you for joining us.
I enjoy it. Thank you.
That was Prairie Public's CEO, John Harris, with the director of the state's tourism office, Sarah Audie Coleman, in an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show. You can watch Prairie Pulse Thursdays on the television service of Prairie Public at 8 p.m. And this week, John Harris will visit with Jessica Christie from the North Dakota Council on the Arts.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 19th. Inventors in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were busy perfecting self-propelled vehicles. They experimented with steam-powered as well as gas-powered automobiles. It was exciting to zip down the road at the blazing speed of 8 miles per hour. But the risks of such travel became apparent almost immediately. With no traffic laws and no safety features, even a slow-moving vehicle could be a menace. In 1923, a woman was struck and killed by an automobile in England. This demonstrated that the vehicles could be deadly to pedestrians as well as passengers. On February 27, 1927, 7-year-old Leroy Venormi was playing in front of his home in Linton. Adolf Spitzer was driving in the area when he lost control of his car. The accident happened when Leroy's younger brother started to cross the street. Spitzer swerved to miss the boy and ran up onto the sidewalk. The car struck Leroy, killing him instantly. Spitzer was arrested on a charge of second-degree manslaughter. A coroner's jury blamed the accident on careless driving at excessive speed. On this date, in 1927, witnesses gave their testimony in Spitzer's trial. A 12-year-old girl took the stand. She said she was watching from her porch when she saw Spitzer's car coming down the road at a high rate of speed. The car swerved and jumped the curb, striking the boy. L. Dyer, a former county judge, also testified that he saw Spitzer driving very fast before swerving and losing control of the car. Leroy's mother broke down in tears as she testified about the death of her son. The defense lawyers tried to get the witnesses to vary their testimony. They wanted them to admit they saw Spitzer swerve to avoid the other boy. But the witnesses stuck to their story, saying the other boy had seen the car and stopped crossing the street. They also blamed speeding for Spitzer's inability to control his car. The jury deliberated for 7 hours before returning a verdict: guilty of second-degree manslaughter. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
All right, time to play along. Here are some clues to the identity of our guest at our first ever live in-session event.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
You talking to me?
He's an importer-exporter, okay?
Get it? He is Rob, I assume that's short for Robert Port, the much-read opinion columnist and podcaster. And he'll be with us Thursday, May 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the new Craft Event Space in downtown Fargo. We'll be talking lots of legislature and other issues on the minds of North Dakotans. And if reading Rob Port has ever made you feel seen and heard or seething with disagreement, well, you'll get a chance to ask Rob anything you want. Just bring your North Dakota and Minnesota nice, please.
You have no call to get snippy with me. I'm just doing my job here.
You can reserve your free tickets now at prairiepublic.org.
And that's a wrap for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Breanne Anderson, Director of Community Life at Bethany Retirement Living, has been named North Dakota Activity Professional of the Year. We'll hear how her creative spirit and dedication are making a difference in the lives of long-term care residents across the state. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.